concept two at the South Pole, observing B-modes. That is not data. That is an artist's impression. Inflation causes B-modes, and I think Kendrick went over this well. And you probably don't need a primer in this audience, so it's nice. We're going to show vector plots later, which are fun. So just keep in mind that the intrinsic lambda CDM E-mode pattern that we expect from just standard acoustic oscillations form this curl-free pattern. And a B-mode pattern is, I think, technically referred to as swirliness. Let's see. Is this a laser pointer? Yeah. Oh, perfect. So this is what the landscape looked like a couple weeks ago. These are upper limits, the B-mode spectrum. The solid line is the lensing expectation from standard lambda CDM. The dashed lines correspond to different tensor to scalar ratios R. And so far, the best upper limits before this was R less, from B-modes alone, was R less than 0.7, which are these gray points from the BICEP 1 experiment, which is a predecessor to BICEP 2. So enter BICEP 2, reporting a detection of degree scale B-modes. And this is our collaboration. We are a mid-sized collaboration, not too large, certainly much smaller than Planck. Definitely one of the smaller CMB collaborations. This is our group meeting at Caltech a couple years ago. So why BICEP 2? Or maybe not why BICEP 2, but why from the ground, not from a satellite? I'll take this chance to plug ground-based CMB polarization experiments. So we take a different strategy than a satellite. We integrate for a very long time in a very small patch of sky. So we get very, very high signal-to-noise measurements of individual modes. In principle, you know, a full sky map would be as sensitive to B-modes, to polarization. But we go very deep, and so with very high signal-to-noise measurements of individual modes, any low-level systematics are not as important for a high signal-to-noise measurement. A low-level systematic over an entire map could be more of an issue. So raw sensitivity could be the same for the two experiments, but having a deep map is a good way to go for a high-confidence detection. We also, by focusing on a very small patch, we get to avoid foregrounds. We observe in a very clean region of the sky. Because we're on the ground, we can have all sorts of calibration measurements that we do in situ with the experiment there as it is set up, which is very powerful for believing our measurements. We have a rapid technology cycle, so we get to deploy the latest and the greatest technology, whereas technology for a satellite typically gets frozen in years and years before. And obviously, it's noisier from the ground, but we practice what we like to call relentless observing, where we just hammer on the same patch of sky for years. BICEP 2 results were 3 years of data. So we like the ground. So we go to the South Pole. This is an image of the Dark Sector Laboratory on the high Antarctic plateau. This is about 10,000 feet, sitting on about 2 kilometers of ice. This is the BICEP experiment here. This is you can't see the telescope. It's inside this conical ground shield that shields the telescope from any ground pickup we might get. And in the background is the 10-meter South Pole telescope, which is about to really kill the high LEE and high LBB. The South Pole, in particular, is a great place to go on the ground. The logistical support is amazing. We have power provided to us. Liquid cryogens, data uplinks, they feed us, we don't have to worry about it, there's entertainment. And you know, beyond that, we have 24-hour coverage of this very clean region of sky that's maybe unfortunately termed the Southern Hole. It's high, 10,000 feet. So mostly what we see when we look out is water vapor and oxygen in the atmosphere. If you can get to a place that's very high and dry, it makes it very clean. Another popular place is the Atacama Desert in Chile, but the South Pole is definitely one of the best. So we go in there in the summer and work on the telescope and get it running and take calibration measurements. But then the sun goes down, one day and doesn't rise for another 6 months. And we leave behind a winter rover who gets to see this. I've never seen this. But once they're there. And the telescope just integrates on the same patch of sky for the entire austral winter. So the BICEP 2 telescope is very small. It's a very simple design. This rendering of the telescope tubes is about 2 meters, about as tall as I am. There are two lenses, an objective lens and an eyepiece lens. Extremely simple optical design. They're made out of plastic, but they're transparent in the microwave. And then at the focal plane are detectors. And I should say this design is common to BICEP 1, BICEP 2, and Keck, with the exception of the focal plane changes. The whole thing is cooled to 4 Kelvin. This is great. This is one advantage of a very small telescope. We can cool everything, including all the optics. And it's tiny, so we can put it on this really neat mount. This is a picture of the mount. This is a picture of BICEP 1, actually, in the testing phases in the Caltech High Bay. This mount provides an axis of, in addition to azimuth and elevation, provides a third axis of motion, which is boresight rotation. So we can take the entire telescope, optics included, and rotate it around the line of sight. This ends up being very powerful. So BICEP 2 is actually the second in a progression of experiments, a whole campaign. This is BICEP 1, which ran from 2006 to 2008. It had many fewer detectors than BICEP 2. That's a picture of the BICEP 1's focal plane, although the optics and everything else are very, very, very similar. BICEP 2 observed from 2010 to 2012, and the main difference between BICEP 1 and BICEP 2 is a vast increase in the number of detectors in the focal plane, enabled by the technology that I'll talk about in a second. The Keck array, here labeled SPUD, sometimes it's referred to as both, is right next door to BICEP 2 at the South Pole, and it is basically just BICEP 2 on steroids. It's just 5 individual BICEP 2 receivers on the same mount. Not liquid helium cooled anymore, pulse tube cooled, but it's just BICEP 2 cloned 5 times over, and this is currently running. It's 2 years of data. And under construction right now and set to deploy in 2014, which it will, is BICEP 3. It's slightly different optical design, but very similar. It's going to be at the South Pole. It is the same number of detectors as the Keck array, but whereas BICEP 2 is all at 150 gigahertz, and the first 2 years of Keck data were all at 150 gigahertz, BICEP 3 will deploy all at 100 gigahertz, which will be great for trying to disentangle foregrounds. Oops. Right, so moving from BICEP 1, which previously had the best limits from B-mode limits, to BICEP 2, the primary difference was the increase in the number of detectors and the focal plane technology. So it's just worth a few words about the actual detectors that we use. This is, again, an image of the BICEP 2 focal plane. There are 4 tiles, 1, 2, 3, 4, and these are manufactured monolithically from silicon wafers in a process very similar to how you would make microchips. Here's a blow-up. Each one of these tiles consists of polarization-sensitive pixels. You can see the squares here on each tile. And each of those tiles actually consists of 2 detectors, a detector that's sensitive to horizontal polarization and a detector that's sensitive to vertical polarization. Those are the antennas. The coherent signal from those antennas gets passed through a band-defining filter. And then the coherent power gets deposited on this little guy, a transition edge sensor, which is really cool. It is cooled, so it's right at the superconducting transition. And so resistance is varying, is a very steep function of temperature. And so this is biased to keep it on the transition temperature. And as more optical power becomes incident on it, it wants to heat up. Resistance wants to go up, but we keep it biased right on the transition. And so that is what enables the very, very sensitive measurement of the temperature of this thing, and because it's coupled to antennas, the incoming optical power. I also want to point out here in this zoom-in, you can actually see what these antennas are. Whereas, you know, BICEP 1's antennas is perhaps a easier cartoon picture, were really just little wires that are strung horizontally or vertically. Very, very conceptually simple. These, we don't have wires, we have little slot antennas. And you can see the vertical slot antennas and the horizontal slot antennas. So these are only sensitive to vertical and horizontal polarization. And the signal, the power incident on these slot antennas are summed coherently to form a beam. So this is aperture synthesis right on this chip. And they're summed independently and deposited, the power is deposited on separate TES sensors. And so this is what enables the detection of polarization, or the separation of polarization. And so these are interleaved in the focal plane. So in the same spot in the focal plane, you have dual polarization sensitivity for a given pixel. So this is a bicep 2 focal plane projected onto the sky. It's very large. It's about 15 degrees by 15 degrees, maybe 20 degrees by 20 degrees. That's, what, 30 full moons by 30 full moons? It's huge. So this is, you know, this is a very large region. Well, it's a small region of sky compared to the whole sky, but the focal plane is quite large. The field of view is big. This is a cartoon illustrating what I was saying. Each one of these little detectors, pixels here, corresponds to a vertical and a horizontal polarized sensitive pair. And the basic measurement that we make is to take the telescope and scan it across the sky. So we're going to take the focal plane and just raster back and forth forever. And if you sum the time streams coming from these two detectors, you get a measurement of the CMB temperature. If you difference the time streams coming from these two detectors, you get a measurement of the CMB polarization. If the CMB, this is a map of the unpolarized, the CMB temperature. If the CMB were unpolarized and you difference the time streams coming from these two detectors, you would get zero. And so this is just to give you a sense of sort of what a base data product is. This is all the channels all overlaid. What you're seeing primarily is atmosphere here. This is summing the two channels. And this is differencing the two channels. The atmosphere is very, very unpolarized. It's not polarized at all. So when you difference, you get something that's just consistent with photon noise. Arbitrary feedback units. We perform absolute calibration at a later stage against Planck. So these are arbitrary feedback units. So we bin all that time stream data from 3 years into map pixels. And these are the BICEP2 maps that we have produced. The temperature map, Stokes Q, and Stokes U. And immediately apparent, I guess if you're an expert, is the lambda CDM E-mode pattern, which is a up, down, left, right pattern in Q and a diagonal pattern in U. As Kendrick said, we also form jackknife maps. So if we just make a map from the first half of our data and make a map from the second half of our data, and we subtract those two maps, all the signals should cancel, and we should get something that's consistent with noise. So this is the temporal jackknife. And it is consistent with noise. And we'll talk about that more later. This is a fun movie. So this is a movie of BICEP2 integrating down over time. Here's 3 years of BICEP2 on the x-axis, the total sensitivity. And you can see the lambda CDM E-mode pattern becoming very apparent. And the jackknife maps integrating down to consistent with noise. And you can see just how high signal to noise this detection of the E-mode pattern is, because already we're very, very high signal to noise, and we're still just at the end of 2012. Love that movie. Right, so take the Stokes QNU maps. Instead of representing it as Stokes QNU, we'll just represent it as a vector map. So this is a total polarization map from BICEP2. And note the scale. The length of the vectors are 1.7 microkelvin. And what you see is the E-mode pattern, curl-free. So we take our total polarization signal and decompose it into E and B. So if we decompose it just into B and plot those vectors, this is what we get. It's very, very, very small compared to the total E-mode pattern. So now you can't really see much there. Maybe you can start to see some swirliness. But if we blow up the scale, this is the B-mode pattern that BICEP2 measures. Sort of by definition, this is going to be swirly because it's B-modes. And we've broken it down. I've also elided a step here, EB separation, that I want to just touch on for a second. So in going from BICEP2 total polarization to B modes, we've done this EB separation. And this is actually a non-trivial thing to do. So let me just explain this for a second. If you want to decompose a polarization signal into E and B, E and B form a complete orthogonal or an orthogonal basis defined over the full sky. So if you only measure a fraction of the sky, you cannot separate E and B cleanly. So what this is just a simulation. This is a noiseless simulation with lambda CDM E modes on the top, no lensing, and no lensing, no noise. So any B mode signal here, I think my, oh no, there it is. Any B mode signal here is all E to B mixing. And this is without any sort of purification. This is just a very naive separation. Kendrick has done a lot of work developing EB separation estimators. And applying this gets rid of the EB mixing from only measuring a small patch of sky. And it works really well. We've used this for years and years. And it's really easy to implement, and we love it. And Bicep 1 used it. And we use it in places in the paper. It gets rid of a lot of this noise. I should say this isn't a biased term. We know exactly what this is because we know what we do in the analysis. We measure it with simulation. But it does add uncertainty to our band powers. So we're still left with some residual EB mixing. And this comes from the filtering that we do in our analysis. So any filtering we do to our time streams, to our maps, distorts the intrinsic E mode pattern and creates some B modes. We know exactly what that is, but it adds uncertainty to our total band powers. So we have developed a map-based purification scheme that we test it empirically. It just works. I won't go into the specifics, but I will say it's very non-trivial to implement the map-based purification that we use. So I've actually come with to implore you. Other people want to implore you to maybe think hard about this and come up with something as easy to implement as what Kendrick did, because that would make our lives much easier. So now that we've cleaned out all the E to B mixing, this is sort of what we get. The top panel here is the Bicep 2 B mode pattern. And it is a combination of noise, hopefully intrinsic signal. And the way that we judge that is by comparing to simulations that include Bicep 2 noise and lambda CDM lensing. And immediately you can see that the measured signal is much brighter than anything you would expect from lensing or noise. So we have many Monte Carlo realizations of lensing plus noise. And we use the Monte Carlo realizations of this to derive the error bars on our power spectra. So now we turn this into power spectra with error bars derived from simulation. And these are the results. Kendrick showed this. Kendrick pointed out that these are jackknives. These are not residuals. People always think these are residuals, but they're jackknives. So if you'll note the scale here. So let's just look at TT for a second. The signal is at like 5,000 microkelvin squared. The jackknife here, which is representative of the noise, is at like 0.1 microkelvin squared. That's huge signal to noise in individual TT band powers. So we're reporting the jackknife PTEs here for the temporal split jackknife. Everything looks good in this plot. We don't formally report TT jackknives, but maybe I should just point out for a second, since we're going to talk about systematics. The signal to noise here is like 50,000. You can imagine, say the overall calibration of our instrument from the first half of the first half of the 3 years to the second half of the 3 years changed by one part in 10,000. We wouldn't care. It wouldn't leak E to B, or it wouldn't leak T to B. Wouldn't matter for any sort of measurement at all, but it would fail this jackknife. So the fact that we pass this jackknife is just tremendous to me. EE is a little bit more difficult to see, but the signal to noise in EE is really, really high too. There may be a plot of that shows this better later. And you, of course, note an excess in BB. So let's look at BB. We find that it's consistent at high L with lambda CDM, but a very strong excess at low L. The significance, not assuming any model of inflationary gravity waves, or R, the significance of the deviation of the black points from the lambda CDM curve, the solid line, is at 5.2 sigma. I will say that 5.2 sigma number uses the first five bound powers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you use all 9 bound powers, including these ones, that significance only goes up to 5.3. This significance is driven entirely by this low L bit, not by these or anything. Right. I thought I'd show this too. This is another illustration that the deviation from lambda CDM occurs all at low L. These gray lines are all of our Monte Carlo realizations of lensing plus bicep 2 noise plus R of 0. And those high L points are just, you know, not surprising. When you look at as many Monte Carlo realizations of, you know, of we have 500. Yeah, so it's a little bit to tell. It's a little bit hard to tell from this plot because it loses information in the middle. Fine, but you could plot 50, and it still just looks unremarkable. So this begs the question: what have we measured? So I'm going to harp on instrumental systematics for a while. Like I said, we form all these jackknives. We split the data in different kinds of ways to probe for different kinds of effects. We form way more jackknives for bicep 2 than we form for bicep 1. So one, this is the temporal jackknife. We just split by time, make a map from the first half of the data, make a map from the second half of the data, subtract it. We do splits by detectors. So these are maps of detectors in the bicep 2 focal plane. We can make a map from, say, this tile and that tile, make a map from this tile and that tile, and subtract them. One of my favorites is the focal plane inner-outer jackknife, where we make a map from the inner from the channels in the inner part of the focal plane, and make a separate map from the channels in the outer part of the focal plane, and make sure they're consistent. This is probably the most powerful jackknife that Kendrick already mentioned, split by bore site orientation. We rotate the entire telescope, make maps of different bore sites orientations, and that's a good one. We make maps of the sky when it's located at one region of azimuth versus when it's located at another region of azimuth. If we're getting ground-based pickup, this should contaminate that jackknife. We make jackknives based on intrinsic detector properties, and basically anything we can think of. Yes?
Let me just preface this question by saying that I had no idea what a jackknife test was 2 weeks ago, so bear that in mind. But looking at this table, there are less than 100 entries here.
There are actually 160 something.
There are? Okay.
So there's 14 jackknives.
There's 168. That's right.
Yeah.
40. Okay. So and those are probabilities, right? Those are probabilities to exceed.
Yes. Take the chi-square, turn it into a probability to exceed.
So there's I think 7 that are less than 0.01, if you count.
Sure. Yeah.
That seems like a little bit too many. If there's
okay.
If there's 160.
So there are about 160 numbers in this table. They're all completely correlated.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
So the statement, if somebody says that this table has 100 numbers and you expect only one to be less than 1%, that is a false statement. That is just not true. So there's 14 jackknives. I mean, it's a good question. There's 14 jackknives, and we form 4 statistics for each jackknife. I probably should have said what statistics we form. We form a chi-square using the first 5 band powers. Then we form a chi-square using all 9 band powers. So those chi-squares are very, very correlated. Then we form a chi-test. This is the third column. It's called the chi-test. It's basically just the chi-square without the squared. And it tests if all the data points are either high or low. And we do that for the first 5 band powers. And we do that for all 9 band powers. And so, you know, all the numbers in here are correlated. So no, you don't expect just one failure. Or one low number. In the paper, we also, so I mentioned this TT jackknife, the very, very high signal to noise, and TT. So we don't report TT jackknives on account of this. I mean, they're basically fine, but you know, they skew a little to the low side because it's incredibly high signal to noise. We're getting to this regime in EE also. So you notice, like, maybe it's hard to read, but so look at this. So the EE, right, a really high signal to noise, EE. 4 of those low numbers are all here in the EE tile. You know, these are all the same jackknife, and it's the really high signal to noise one. So
So if instead you assume that each one of those jackknives has 100% correlation between the 12 numbers that's in there, or 16 numbers, no, 12 numbers, you could still, four numbers, you could still ask that question about the 14 jackknives or 14 times three jackknives and say there's two of them that are less than 0.1% or 1%. I'm not suggesting that I'm worried about the
you could I mean yeah once you play this here, game if I mean if we're at two and there's 160 numbers in the table then I'm personally fine with this. You know, there's only one BB number
If I can't read the table prepared, but
I know, sorry.
This really extensively in the paper, and as I recall, only one of the B mode associated. There's only one.
Yeah, yeah. So what I was trying to point out is that the four of those. I mean, we're talking about seven numbers here. Four of those numbers are EE, which I just offered. You know, there's a good explanation for why you would expect those to be maybe a little on the low side, and four of those are the same jackknife. There's one like really low number. I forget where it is. It's one of the MUX row. It's one of the multiplexing numbers.
It's MUX row BB.
Fine, MUX row BB. This is the one, right? And it's one.
Another point is that it's not only a question of whether or not there is statistically significant failures of jackknives, which is one argument, one question. But more importantly, are the failures, even if they are significant, anywhere close to being a problem with the results? And I think that's the real point here, is that even the failures are tiny.
Yeah, right. For our detected signal, with very high signal to noise, apparently, you know, in BB, small jackknife failures don't imply large contamination. But I dispute whether such a thing as a BB jackknife failure in this table. I don't think there is. There's one low number, but even if there were a small one, I wouldn't be worried. So this is just a visualization of these jackknife spectra. These are band power deviation plots. So just plot the jackknife spectrum normalized to the error bar. And so the welter of lines here are simulations. And you can see 0 and the plus or minus 1 and 2 sigma lines. So these are the EB jackknives. These are all jackknives except for the top left panel here, which is the signal, no jackknife. So these should all be consistent with 0, and they bounce. And so we compute the PDE statistic from these plots. They all bounce around 0. Same thing for EE. It's been pointed out that the tile is a little low, and you can see it's a little low here, but nothing, you know, it doesn't look particularly crazy in this plot. And then you look at BB, and everything looks fine, except the band power deviations are very, very high compared to lambda CDM at low L. And this is our very, very high significance detection. So it's worth it to maybe flip through these again, give you an idea. So this is sort of bouncing around 0, and immediately BB is very apparent. This is the distribution of the PTEs. They're basically uniform for BB. So these are the jackknives. We can use the jackknives to rule out lots of classes of systematics. Well, we can do a better job for some systematics. So let me pay attention to classes of systematics that would leak temperature into polarization. Beam systematics. Where am I at? 30 minutes. So we talk about beams. I don't know. Maybe I should explain what a beam is. You can think of either light coming into the telescope, becoming incident on the focal plane, being focused down to the focal plane. Or it's perfectly valid to think of the time reverse sense. We put a little light bulb at the focal plane, and you illuminate the aperture and form a beam out to the sky. And oftentimes, it's more convenient to talk about forming a beam. So when I talk about the telescope beam, I'm talking about, other people would call it the point spread function or something. It is just the response of a detector to power on the sky. So I'll point out again that each of these detectors is an orthogonally polarized detector pair. And so they nominally point to the same location on the CMB sky. And if the CMB is unpolarized, then if you difference the signal coming from these two, you should get zero. However, this assumes that the response of the A detector to the CMB is exactly the same as the B detector's response to the CMB. If the response of the CMB between these two detectors is different at all, then even if the CMB is unpolarized, you get a non-zero difference signal. And that is a direct contamination of polarization. So this is what I mean when I'm talking about beam systematics, or systematics that leak temperature into polarization. So let me give an example. There's lots of things that can do this, well, a few things that can do this, and this is one of them. A slight pointing center mismatch. So imagine that the A detector is pointed at one location in the sky, and the B detector, which is supposed to be pointed at the exact same location in the sky, is in fact pointed somewhere slightly different. If they observe different, this is what the difference beam would look like. The A beam minus the B beam is this dipole. And the leakage, the temperature into polarization leakage, would be the convolution of this difference beam with the CMBT. So this is just a little cartoon of this. This is the Planck T-map. And I've just illustrated grossly exaggerated differential, we call it differential pointing, grossly exaggerated differential track here. So whereas A and B should be measuring the same part of the sky, they're in fact measuring different parts of the sky. And so A minus B, instead of being zero in the case of unpolarized CMB, is actually measuring, you know, you get a hot spot minus a cold spot, and that's non-zero. And so the solid line here is the A minus B difference that you would expect for such a pointing offset. So this would leak temperature into polarization. We talk about it in the paper, and so I'll mention it here. This is one novel technique that we use. We call it deprojection. And it just, it's really simple, actually. So what you can say, if you go back to the Planck T-map here, even if you don't know what the splitting is, you know what the mean trajectory of the detector is, the detector pair is. You know what the Planck T sky is, because we have this. This, the top track minus the bottom track, is just proportional to the first derivative of the CMB in the y direction here. And we have maps of the first derivative of the CMB from Planck. And so if you just form a template that is the first derivative of the CMB along this track and fit it to your pair difference time stream, you can fit a template for the leakage and remove it. And this is what we do, and this is called deprojection. So here, it's hard to see, but I've shown the A minus B time stream in solid and a scaled version of the first derivative time stream, a leakage template time stream, you know, and it fits perfectly.
What's the granularity of that procedure? Is it like per detector pair?
It's per detector pair, and we do it on about 10-hour chunks of data. So we don't assume that anything is constant on timescales longer than 10 hours. Per pair, per 10 hours. I mean, we expect beam systematics to be entirely static relative gain, for instance, though, which would couple not to the first derivative, but to the zeroth derivative. This the T-map itself, could vary in time, so 10 hours. So this is a fun technique. So we don't just fit for differential pointing. We fit for differential pointing. We fit for a differential gain. We fit for the different modes of mismatch elliptical Gaussians. This is a differential beam width difference beam, and this is what differential ellipticity looks like. It's a quadrupole. And whereas the differential pointing dipole coupled to the first derivative of the CMB, the differential gain couples to the zeroth derivative of the CMB. These two couple to various combinations of the second and cross derivatives of the CMB. This will be detailed in the upcoming systematics paper. And so we can deproject modes corresponding to this. And this is our predicted leakage using calibration data as input under different deprojections. So this would be the signal with no deprojection, the green line. And it's large. This is primarily driven by differential pointing. It's already below an RF.2 signal. If we deproject differential gain, We expect this reduction. We deproject differential. This is deprojecting differential pointing. Sorry, going from green to cyan. Then deprojecting differential gain gets us down to these lines, and deprojecting a differential ellipticity gets us down to this. And this last line here would be the portion of our beams that is not parameterized by an elliptical Gaussian. I want to be very, very clear. We parameterize our beams, our ideal beams, as elliptical Gaussians for the purposes of fitting and removing leakage. But when we predict how much leakage we have, we do not assume that our beams are elliptical Gaussians.
This is kind of an open-ended question, but could you say a little bit more about the assumptions that go into this simulation? Like, do you assume uncorrelated,
This is coming next.
Okay.
Right. So, like I said, we don't assume our beams are elliptical Gaussians. We have very high signal-to-noise calibration data. So this is a picture of BICEP 2, probably BICEP 2, could be BICEP 1. Located in its ground shield at the South Pole, there's a building hundreds of yards away. This is actually where the Keck is. And there's a mast on this building. And on top of this mast, we put a microwave point source. And we observe this thing. Here we have to have an angled flat mirror on the top of the telescope because you can't see it directly. It's sitting down on this ground shield. But we just observe this source. And so we raster over it. And we have very high fidelity maps of all of our beams. And this is one of them. So we have this for every single channel. This is data, right? You can see a little crosstalk feature here. So we know what our crosstalk is from many different methods, including these beam maps. What's the scale in here? Yeah, I mean, this is one channel, and we get down to this this first side lobe here at, like, you know, minus 25 dB. The crosstalk coefficients don't have to be the same. For each channel, this is pretty technical. For each channel, one of the crosstalk neighbors is adjacent in the focal plane, and the other crosstalk neighbor is that same pair. Okay. So we use these as inputs to simulation. Really simple simulation, actually. Just take the beams, convolve it with the Planck T-map, and predict how much leakage you get. We can do this explicit convolution because we're at the South Pole, there's no sky rotation, all of our scans are constant elevation, and we don't change the telescope orientation as we scan. So you only need to do this convolution once per detector and per boresight orientation, so it's pretty easy to do. So you don't have to believe that any of this works or that any of our predictions are right. We know they're right. So this is R of 0.2 from data. Let me see where I'm going. So this is that last line in that plot I showed you. This is that black line that I said was our ultimate leakage from beam mismatch. And it's low and it's negligible. This is deprojecting everything except for this elliptical mode. Now the bottom plot, I haven't shown any real data here on the top, but the bottom plot, I'm showing a jackknife. I'm showing in particular the focal plane inner outer jackknife, which we already expect and know just from beam maps will be the most affected by beam ellipticity. And you can see that without deprojecting ellipticity, the prediction of our simulation is borne out by the jackknife data. And in fact, we need differential ellipticity deprojection to pass this jackknife. The contamination is very low here, though. I mean, you can see the level of contamination at L of 200, L of 100. Was that like 0.01, 0.02 microkelvin squared? It's roughly comparable to what's in here. So this is saying this jackknife probe is a good test of how much contamination we expect in BB. But we do differential ellipticity deprojection. And when we do that, both the simulation and the real data respond exactly the same. So we've used the behavior of our jackknives under these different deprojection options, predicted by our simulations of high signal-to-noise beam maps, to really build confidence that we know what we're doing. We know what our temperature to polarization leakage is. We know that we have a handle on it with deprojection. We're incredibly confident that there's no residual T to pole leakage from beam mismatch. So that's just beam mismatch. There's obviously more systematics, and we've thought of all of them that we could. And we've tried to limit them, and this is the plot of the limits on all of the ones. We've tried to think of thermal mismatch, thermal fluctuations in the focal plane that different detectors respond differently to. Our polarization angle errors, we've thought very hard about. I bet you somebody will ask me about that. I'm not going to mention it. Ghosted beams in the optics, detector transfer functions if the response of temporal response of detectors are different, and crosstalk. And we just can't find anything that would remotely explain what we're seeing. We're very confident that what we're seeing is not a systematic. Additionally, systematic, you would expect different experiments to measure different power. So this is BICEP 1 again. How am I on time? 10 minutes. The optics are very similar, but the focal plane technology is incredibly different. So the aperture is illuminated differently. You would expect BICEP, actually more than expect, we know BICEP 1 has different side lobes than BICEP 2. And so a cross spectrum between BICEP 1 and BICEP 2, which we is the points here, the cross spectrum between BICEP 1 and BICEP 2 is significant at 3 sigma level at 100 gigahertz. And we take this to be additional nice check that we're not affected by systematics. We have cross spectra between not just BICEP 2 and BICEP 1, but also between BICEP 2 and the Keck array, BICEP 2's successor. So these are preliminary data points that we've shown in the paper. Again, the black points, BICEP 2. The gray points are BICEP 1 cross BICEP 2. Now this is 100 BICEP 1 combined, so 100 and 150 gigahertz from BICEP 1 combined. And the blue points are Keck. And we find also a very significant excess of power at low L. I'll also point out that these guys seem to have come down entirely consistent with how much fluctuation we would expect from simulation. So these data are preliminary, and they'll be coming out shortly. I should say that these Keck points are all at 150 gigahertz. Keck array just started observing at 100 gigahertz a few months ago. So we have some data, but when Keck array is published in a few months, hopefully, it will all be at 150. Yeah, so we also haven't included any sample variance, any R of 0.2 sample variance in these plots. And I know, yes, both experiments observe nominally the same patch of sky, but you would be surprised how the different, slightly different scan strategies and filtering between the two effectively change the sample variance between the two. I mean, is this what you're going to object to?
Oh, I suppose I was going to comment that I thought these measurements were fairly close to sample variance limited.
They are,
I didn't realize that the error bars didn't include sample variance. So these are...
None of these error bars include R of 0.2 sample variance.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I can tell you the BICEP 2 error bars in this plot are primarily noise driven.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll show, there's a plot later, and there's one plot in the paper where we finally do include the sample variance here, and the error bars get much bigger.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. But if you do include the sample variance here, yes, it's the same patch of sky, but there is decorrelation between the two maps on account of different filtering. So, we assess this through simulation, and we will assess the compatibility of it. But I don't want to comment on preliminary data too much, but, I wouldn't worry too much. All right. So that's the conclusion of instrumental systematics. We'll talk about foregrounds briefly, and I'll just go briefly through it because I think other people are going to talk about it more. We observe a very, very low foreground region of the sky. We've always expected power in this region of sky to be less than roughly equal to 0.01. So we put limits on synchrotron using WMAP data. So WMAP has Q and U maps. These Q and U maps should be dominated by synchrotron. And in our field, the WMAP, Q and U maps are totally noise dominated. Over the full sky, you see the synchrotron, but you narrow it down to our field and it's noise dominated. So if you take the WMAP, Q and U maps and extrapolate it with a spectral index, If you extrapolate it with a spectral index of -3.3 for synchrotron, you get this is you get an auto spectrum from WMAP K, WMAP 22 gigahertz. That's very low, but this is all noise bias. So we take the WMAP Q and U maps that we've extrapolated and cross-correlate it with BICEP2, and that cross-correlation is the blue line here. And so I'll say this cross-correlation that I'm showing here is extrapolated with a spectral index of -3. In the paper, we use -3.3 to cite this number. So this is actually a little bit more conservative. And it's extremely low. The mean spectral index in our field, according to WMAP, is -3.3. So -3 is conservative. So we think we really rule out synchrotron. Dust is another matter. It's a bit more uncertain. So Kendrick talked about our data-driven models. Planck is Planck early release in the form of PDF slides gives interesting information. There's, of course, all sorts of other models that exist. And of course, we've looked at these and have looked at these for a long time. We've looked at these for a long time when choosing what field to use. And these are just some of them. There's many to choose from. These are the spectra, the dust spectra of those models. The dashed lines in this plot are the auto spectra of these models. And the solid lines are the cross spectrum of these models with BICEP2. And yes, they're models, but they're supposed to reflect reality. They're supposed to model the actual galactic field or magnetic field in the galaxy. So you know these models should cross-correlate, at least at large scales, with BICEP2. And we don't see any evidence for any sort of cross-correlation. The DDM2, which comes from these slides, which is perhaps the best information that we have. See, where is it? Solid blue line, a little uptick at low L, maybe. It's probably on the, it's on the higher side of the other cross spectra, but it's still consistent with zero. And so we think this is a good indication that dust is not a problem in our field. Of course, we need better foreground modeling. We need, you know, we need Planck polarization data. We'll be really happy to see that.
So the cross correlation with all these dust templates is not so.
What's that?
So you don't see a statistically significant cross-correlation with any of these dust templates?
No.
Would you expect to see one if the dust templates were correct, if you put in the BICEP?
Well, yeah, so yes, you would. I mean, you expect to see, you would expect to see a statistically significant cross-correlation if, in fact, you know, we're sensitive enough to see it, if the dust is strong enough to see it. So. The scatter of these dust. Yeah, let me show. I have a backup plot. I don't have a backup plot. It's not really statistical. I mean, the scatter, we take these models and we cross-correlate them with signal plus noise simulations that by construction contain no dust, and you just get some scatter. So you know how sensitive you are going to be to a cross-correlation in these maps. And that scatter is, you know, I'll say that scatter is roughly of about the size of this uptick here for DDM2. It's not statistically significant, you know, maybe makes you scratch your head. I don't know. But it's small, yeah. Okay. So we also have BICEP1. BICEP1, we have BICEP1 100 gigahertz data. And so we can constrain the spectral index. And this is what we do with BICEP1 100 detection. We can rule out a dust spectral index of +1.75 and a synchrotron spectral index of -3 at 2.2 and 2.3 sigma, respectively. So definitely, the spectral index constraint from BICEP1 favors CMB, disfavors synchrotron and dust, but is by no means definitive. So I'm sure you've seen all the bits to R, but if it's not foregrounds and it's not systematics, could be cosmology. So now these points now include sample variance. You notice that the error bars are much bigger. So this is what R of 0.2 sample variance looks like, and it's huge compared to compared to the instrumental noise in BICEP2. So these are very high significance detection. We find the best fit R is 0.2 plus 0.07 minus 0.05. We could integrate down, which is so ruling out R of 0 using a model-dependent fit. We rule out R of 0 at 7.0 sigma. The PTE for the fit of R of 0.2 with these band powers is 0.9, so it's perfectly acceptable. Obviously, logically, we know there are some foregrounds at some level in our map. So we can just take all these different models that we've computed and just subtract the spectra from the band powers and recompute our best fit R. And this is what happens to the likelihood as you do this. The colors match between the two. So who knows which one is right? It's very difficult to assess which one of these, if any, you know, which one of these really reflects reality. If we were forced to choose, we would probably choose the DDM2 cross spectrum. And so using the DDM2 cross spectrum, which is one of the higher ones, R comes down from 0.2 to 0.16, and is still R of 0 is still ruled out at 5.9 sigma. This plot is in the paper. Obviously, there's tension. I won't spend any time talking about this, because I'm sure the rest of the day will be devoted to this. We put this plot in the paper. It's interesting. In no way are we endorsing running of the spectral, the scalar spectral index as a solution. But it is just a simple illustration of a straightforward extension to lambda CDM that could resolve tensions that may exist. Obviously, the specific solution remains to be seen. So, bicep 2. It's a great plot. Most sensitive polarization maps ever made. Model-independent excess over lambda CDM of 5.2 sigma. And that is all coming from the low multipoles where you expect an inflationary gravity wave signal. We really, really do have a handle on our instrumental systematics. There is a systematics paper forthcoming. That should be very soon. We'll detail our checks. Foregrounds don't appear to be large, but obviously more work needs to be done. Eagerly await Planck polarization maps. And assuming an inflationary gravity wave spectrum, we rule out R of 0 at 7 sigma. So thank you.
So just to understand, by default, there's no foreground subtraction at all. Is that right?
Yeah, and the R of 0.2 number is no.
And then if you take the polarization map, the one you call DDM2, and you do subtract that off, then the R lowers down to 0.16 with some error bars, which is then consistent with the Planck upper limits.
Certainly, a combination of different combinations of relief tension. Yeah, I mean, just logically, we know there are foregrounds at some level in our map, so at some level that gets resolved. The question is it enough? I don't know.
So a conservative deduction is there is really no tension.
Somebody else should comment on this. We specifically didn't go look into Planck tensions in the paper. We just fit the BMOD spectrum. Well, the cross spectrum doesn't.
So can I ask? Can I ask a question? Well, two questions related, one related, one not. So, if you were to instead of stating a foreground model, marginalize over a foreground amplitude and include that in the error bars, would that significantly change the significance of your result? So that's my question one. And my question two, if you have for some reason,
we kind of didn't want to marginalize over a bunch of
nuisance problems.
Models that we picked, right?
Well, okay, so that was one thought I had about wondering how that affects it. But then the second thing is, Say you come up with a better EB purification method. The EB purification, if you had some offset, some systematic that that introduced, and I'm sure that you don't see that in your simulations. But if that was the case, none of these jackknife tests would find that, right? And it would be a coherent signal that would be, or a coherent mock signal that would come across.
So
in,
I should
in
the
each
EB,
of
the
your in your KEK, in your bicep one, in your bicep two, and it would mimic a true signal. Is that that's a question? Is that the case?
No, I think I see what you're saying, but the EB separation method that we have is, I mean, for all intents and purposes, perfect. This is a picture of the E to B, a graph of the E to B mixing under these different estimators. What we care about not is the mean level, but the scatter. But even with the mean level, with our EB separation, this is the matrix, and it's for all intents and purposes zero. So EB separation. It's just, there's no EB mixing from this. That's not an issue.
Yeah, I just wanted to, like, just for fun, some historical comments. So, we chase this ambulance chasing. We do it all the time. Just remember some of the examples that I was involved with, just to criticize myself, I guess. Boomerang and Maxima first detected the acoustic peak, and for beautiful first acoustic peak, the second peak. Then there was trouble with nucleosynthesis because and then ended up going away. Or when WMAP first was able to measure polarization, we got a tau, which we had two brownizations and this and that, of course. So anyway, it's fun to chase all of these things, but we do it as a that's the business of the people on the other side of the experiment, but it's probably clear what's going to happen.
What's the schedule for the systematics paper? And it would be great to see a map level consistency check between KEK and a bicep 2.
Yeah.
Right. No, these are two. One's a statement. First one's a question. And
I have to go back to Chicago and finish it. A few weeks.
Excellent. That's great. And would you be willing to say a couple more words about I haven't fully followed the level to which sample variance, looking at the same patch of the sky with two different experiments, can now factor in with a different filtering mechanism. Could you just say a word or two more about that to help me out?
Sure. Right. Just. Okay, sure. I mean, nominally, bicep 2 and bicep 1, or just say bicep 2 and KEK, just use KEK. Nominally, bicep 2 and KEK observe the same patch of sky. But of course, the sample variance isn't just what bounding box you've drawn and cut out from the sky. It's the full sky times some apodization, right? So that apodization, even though we observe nominally the same patch of sky, that apodization can look quite different in the same region of sky between bicep 2 and KEK. So even though it's the same bounding box on the sky, bicep 2 and KEK can actually observe different sample variants because the weighting of the modes on the sky is quite different. Oh, we could, but that would be suboptimal. So instead, we assess, though.
So I've got a question. I'm not sure if you can answer it. It's Planck related. Hmm. If you can't answer it, then that's just fine. I was just wondering, can you go back to the plot that you made together with Planck and NSR plot with Planck and bicep? Yeah.
That one?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So Planck is measured an upper limit on the tensors at the scale 0.002, right? You've got that on the y-axis. And then you are superposing here the contours that bicep has obtained, and I was wondering how at which k do you specify your R constraints here that you are superposing with Planck?
The same.
So and how did you transport R from the multiples, the scale that you observe, how did you transport it over to the same scale as Planck?
I don't think I understand.
So R is not constant. Even if the B-mode amplitude is constant over cosmological scale, R will not be constant because there's the scalar perturbation scale dependent,
okay.
Right? So are these limits that you are placing here on this plot the same limits that you obtain at the cosmological scale that BICEP observed?
This is just relaxing. This is the same Planck constraints on NSNR.
Sure, but
just relaxing running and adding in BICEP 2.
Sorry, I don't understand.
The point.
The definition of R depends on the scale, on the multiple that you obtain
the physical
it at.
Scale. I mean, we chose the 0.002. Yeah, it's just defined at a particular.
Okay. Well, maybe I can take this offline. For example.
Oh, where do we what's the pivot scale for the spectral index?
Exactly. I mean,
oh,
the pivot scale
sure.
for BICEP and Planck are not the same.
I see. I don't. If you're talking about the pivot for the spectral index, I'm not sure where that's.
Sure.
Right. So the blue curve is exactly likelihoods calculated by Planck, then importance sampled with the BICEP data added, right? This is one set of calculations.
Sure. The thing is, when you run a chain, if you do a resampling, you'd need to specify the cosmological scale that you're going to sample your parameters at.
I can't. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know
okay.
That.
I can take it offline. Now.
I think in this plot, R is at 0.002 and NS is at 0.05.
Sorry?
I think what's happening in this plot is R is at 0.002 and NS is at 0.05.
Sure,
and then
sure.
You're point by point in the chain converting to those pivot wave numbers.
The thing is that the BICEP 2 measurement is not at R of 0.002, right? They have R at K of 0.01, something like this, multiple 150.
I don't know where the multiple translates, but I swear is just a definition.
What's that? Okay, so the only comment is that if you choose the BICEP 2 pivot scale, the one that you have your constraints at, and you transport that to Planck's pivot scale, R is not constant. That, exactly. So that's the only comment.
Okay.
Hey, so your beam ellipticity deprojection method makes this assumption that the sky is always the same per instrument orientation, right? So it's the Planck map, and you're working your correction based off that. So the sky isn't rotating. How robust is that with respect to signals that are coherent over your detector but aren't constant in time and are possibly different every time you see them, like atmospheric contamination. So is that a problem? Is that a worry? Or because
so,
that's done upstream in the time stream filtering somehow.
So the deep projection algorithm just handles how much the CMB temperature leaks into polarization, because that will not average down over time because the CMB temperature is there. Atmospheric pickup, this is noise. This is stuff that averages down over time. So we just integrate down and that goes away. That doesn't enter in as a leakage term. That enters in just as noise. Yes, I mean, anything that's not in the Planck map will not be deprojected. But when we talk about temperature to polarization leakage, we're talking about things that aren't statistical noise. We're talking about a systematic that comes from the CMB temperature leaking into polarization. So in terms of, but I mean, we don't assume that the instrument is, I mean, the simulation assumes that the instrument is not rotating, but the deprojection doesn't assume that at all. I mean, the instrument can rotate, the instrument can do whatever it wants. And, you know, unless you think there's a reason that what's in the Planck 143 gigahertz map is changing with time, then. That's noise, though, but that's just noise.
It integrates down
sufficiently. And it integrates down, yeah. I mean, yes, we're sensitive to it. It's noise, but it's not a systematic.
Any further questions?
We plan to. Not in the near term. John Kovac at Harvard has a career grant to make our data public in a way that's usable. But it's not a trivial thing to do, to release map data products that other people can use. So yes, eventually that's going to happen, but probably on the, I'll say, of order year time scale. But that is the intention. Yeah, but you don't know the filtering. Yeah.
When Planck releases its results, it will release it.
Okay, let's thank Chris again.